Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
The most notorious gang leader in Haiti, nicknamed Barbecue, now has a $5 million U.S. bounty on his head.
Well, when you get to $5 million, where are you going to live in Haiti?
Fair point, considering much of the country is controlled by violent gangs. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the search at a U.S. company for a highly skilled and well-paid software engineer.
We're thinking that this guy was going to make a really great employee, a great fit.
That new hire turned out to be a hacker inside North Korea. It's more common than you might imagine. And across Africa, people are struggling with loneliness and isolation.
As Africans, we're usually closely knit in our communities. But these new things that are coming into our societies are now making us far apart.
Looking for ways to restore community and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for joining us this Wednesday. We begin today in Haiti, where a former police officer who now leads the biggest gang in the country has been indicted by the U.S. government. I'm talking about Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier. U.S. officials this week announced criminal charges against Cherizier, along with three Haitian-born American citizens, for conspiring to violate sanctions. The indictment alleges that the men raised cash from the Haitian diaspora in the U.S., to pay the salaries of gang members and purchase firearms on the island of Haiti. Jacqueline Charles has been covering the story for the Miami Herald. Break it down for us, Jacqueline. What's in the indictment against Barbecue?
U.S. authorities presented evidence of conversations between him and one of the named individuals, Basile Richardson, who described himself as a close personal friend of Barbecue. Richardson wired at least $9,300 to Haiti between September 27th and October 12th, 2021. And then in 2024, he also wired as much as $49,000 to Barbecue. Barbecue, of course, has denied this, but what you see is the culmination of 3 years of an investigation, according to U.S. authorities, where they were looking at the financial networks as well as the networks Barbecue allegedly used to acquire arms.
Right. Barbecue has denied these charges. Yesterday, he refuted them in a denial he posted online. Let's hear that.
If the FBI wants me, I'm here. I'm willing to collaborate with them on one condition. There can be no lies told. Basil Richardson is innocent. He has never sent any money to me to finance anything in Haiti. Stop with all those lies and we can collaborate.
So Barbecue there mentioned that man that you just mentioned, Basil Richardson, one of the three Haitian-born naturalized U.S. citizens named also in that indictment. You've been looking into his activities, Jacqueline. Tell us more about him and his cohorts.
So he resides in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He was a trucker. He was actually arrested last month. According to the indictment, he basically had been gathering funding from members of the diaspora, whether it was $20, $100, and he was sending this to Haiti via intermediaries to Barbecue. And one of the issues that stands out in the indictment is U.S. authorities insist that Basil Richardson knew that Cherizier was under U.S. sanctions and even had conversations with him about that.
So the indictment describes a sort of grassroots fundraising effort. The men were targeting 1,000 Haitians living abroad to contribute $20 each. Is support for criminal gangs in the Haitian diaspora that broad?
The argument that is presented in this indictment is not that they were supporting criminal gangs, but that they were supporting a quote-unquote revolution. And what you see when a number of foreign journalists go to Haiti and interview Barbecue, this is what he says that he's doing. This is how he presents himself. Did Basil Richardson really believe this, or was this a cover? We don't know. We'll have to wait for the trial. But the argument is that they were supporting a movement. So if you present it to people in the diaspora who are very frustrated by the situation in Haiti, very disappointed by the perpetual instability, I could see people buying onto this. But did people know that this money was going to the leader of a gang that has essentially been driving displacement and hunger? Then you have more than 1.3 million people who are homeless.
Interestingly, the indictment presents evidence of relatively small amounts of money, tens of thousands of dollars. I mean, don't the gangs operate with much larger budgets?
Exactly. The gangs operate with much larger budgets. And so that was one of the questions I had when I was looking at this indictment, you know, in terms of how strategic or how big of a movement. I mean, what you see is Basil Richardson sending messages to say, hey, I just topped up your phone, or here's a few dollars for, you know, for this. I mean, what kind of revolution can you really finance with a few dollars? I mean, we see this amount of up to $49,000. We see him saying that he had somebody who was ready to invest $50,000, but it's unclear if that money ever really made it. And it's also unclear whether or not the arms ever really made it to Barbecue vis-a-vis Basil Richardson. So there are also a lot of questions here. But I have to remind you that, you know, in May, the U.S. basically designated Barbecue and others as foreign and global terrorists. And when I spoke to experts, you know, what they said is that, look, if you even give these guys a cup of coffee, that's a problem.
So we wondered how Haitians were reacting to these indictments out of Washington. So we reached out to a journalist, Widlaw Merencourt, in Port-au-Prince. We speak with him from time to time. He told us Haitians were unimpressed.
We all know in Haiti where the gang leaders are. We all know which territory they control, and the police and the population, we all know. You know, if you want to talk to Barbecue, you just have to go to Delma, 19 and lower, and you will find him, right? So it's not a question of where he is, where he's hiding, and whether people have information that can lead to his arrest. The question is whether the U.S. and its partners at the Haitian National Police have the means and the capacity to go to these spaces and pick him up and stop the bloodshed. And I do think most Haitians today are really skeptical as to whether such a thing will ever happen.
Yeah, so Delmo, that's the part of Port-au-Prince where Barbecue resides. Jacqueline, the U.S. is offering a $5 million reward for information leading to Barbecue's arrest. How could that change the situation for him?
Well, when you get to $5 million, where are you going to live in Haiti? I mean, you know, Widlaw is right. Foreign journalists have been able to interview Barbecue, one just a few days before this. So how is it that the U.S. government is saying we don't know where he is? People are looking at this and saying that it's sort of smoke and mirrors. $5 million, but somebody joke, okay, but if you offer green cards, maybe somebody will take it. The reality is that you still have to live in this country. Barbecue is one of a number of gang leaders. Well, he has been most vocal, most visible, but he is certainly not the only one. And so there is a lot of skepticism on both sides. I mean, on the part of Haitians in Haiti and people here. I think people were much more interested in the Basil Richardson angle in terms of here's someone who is wiring money to Haiti, supposedly to his friend who happens to be a gang leader, and now he finds himself criminally charged.
I've been speaking with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles about the indictment unsealed in Washington yesterday of Haitian gang leader Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier and three Haitian-American accomplices. Thank you very much, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Berlin today, meeting with European leaders. President Trump also joined online. The meeting was quickly arranged ahead of Friday's face-to-face in Alaska between Trump and President Vladimir Putin of Russia about the war in Ukraine. Zelensky said after today's meeting that his country must be at the table for negotiations and that Ukraine is insisting on a ceasefire and security guarantees.
Сьогодні, до речі, президент Трамп сказав про підтримку цього і про готовність Америки брати участь.
Zelensky also said that President Trump supports this idea. Zelensky went on to say that Putin is bluffing and does not really want peace, that the Russian leader wants to occupy Ukraine. President Trump, who was making an appearance at the Kennedy Center in Washington, also took questions from reporters after the meeting and was asked if Russia would face any consequences if Putin does not agree to a ceasefire in Friday's meeting.
Yes, they will. Yeah.
What will the consequences be?
There will be
sanctions, tariffs?
There will be, I don't have to say, there will be very severe consequences, yes.
Trump described Friday's Alaska summit as an opportunity to, quote, find out where we are and what we're doing. He said the meeting on Friday could lead to a second summit with Putin and a possible opportunity for the Russian leader to meet directly with Zelensky. Join us tomorrow on the show for a preview of the Alaska summit and what's at stake for Ukrainians. Earlier this summer, a mob rampaged through a town in southeast Spain on the hunt, as they said, for North Africans. People in the crowd were armed and masked. Police in this town of Pacheco dispersed the mob, but only after 3 days of rioting. Human rights activists said the violence was part of a larger campaign by far-right extremists to demonize immigrants. Well, this week in the nearby town of Humia, North Africans have again been targeted, this time for their religion. The mayor just told Muslim residents they can no longer use the local gym for religious celebrations. The World's Jerry Haddon has more.
The ban on Muslim activities in the local gym is not explicit. All we did was say the sports club is for sports only, conservative mayor Severa González told reporters this week, or she said, for activities organized by town hall. If you read the ordinance, she said, none of the following words appear, Islamic community or Muslims. The thing is, though, Humilla's Islamic community, its Muslims, have been using the sports center for large religious events for years now because they don't have their own big space. And it's never been a problem, some locals say. One resident who appears unidentified on local TV says he's angry about the bad reputation his town is getting. Anyone with two eyes and two legs, he says, can walk around town and see that everyone here gets along just fine. But in Humilla, Spain's far-right Vox Party argues that things are not fine at all. Vox often jumps on the chance to denigrate Islam, which it calls incompatible with European values. Spain has one of the most tolerant policies toward undocumented migrants in all of Europe. So far this year, nearly 17,000 migrants have come to Spain without papers or permission. Most are Muslims from Africa. Recent polls show that a growing number of voters favor tightening borders, and Vox is capitalizing on that concern. In Humilla, Vox spokesman Juan Agustin Carrillo declared in a town hall session that he doesn't want Muslims practicing in public. If someone's such a fan of Muslim celebrations, he said, then host them on your own property. That way you can party with them as much as you want. As Vox ramps up its anti-Islam, anti-immigrant rhetoric, Spain's influential Catholic bishops have chimed in. They've called on Spaniards to embrace immigrants and for the government to grant new arrivals residency. Vox is pushing back. Party leader Santiago Abascal said this week that the Catholic Church is beholden to Spain's government because it receives public subsidies. Or maybe, he said, it's simply been muzzled after all of its pedophile priest scandals that have rocked the church in recent decades. All this tension over immigration couldn't come at a worse time for underage migrants who've come to Spain seeking asylum. Thousands of them have been languishing in detention centers on Spain's Canary Islands. Today, some are being moved to the mainland under court order. And this has created its own controversy around safety and security. In May, a dozen Moroccan teens escaped from a detention center in a town called Piera. They roamed the streets with sticks and knives, allegedly looking for some local kids they'd argued with. In this video, filmed by a resident from a balcony, police marched the disarmed migrants back to their shelter, with several patrol cars following. Locals in Piera told me last month that incidents like this have left people scared of the young immigrants. A woman working in a gas station complained that the teens are often left unsupervised and get into trouble.
Intentaron apuñalar al hijo de una amiga mía.
The woman, who didn't want to give her name out of fear of being branded a racist, said that one of the migrants tried to slash the face of a local boy during an argument. That case is headed for trial. It's not about them being Moroccan or Chinese or whatever, she told me. The problem is that these kids arrive without parents, without family, and their lives are totally unstructured. Days after the knife attack, hundreds of Piera residents marched to have the Center for Unaccompanied Minors closed. And Vox was there, broadcasting the discontent. The people of Piera are out on the streets, said Vox member Alberto Tarradas in a video on X. We're demanding security for our families and kids. Right around this time, the town's brand new mosque had been set on fire, days before its inauguration. At the time, the cause of the blaze was unknown. Since then, fire inspectors have confirmed suspicions. The fire was set on purpose. Muslim leaders are calling for peace. even as far-right activists continue to claim Islam has no place in Spain. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
Coming up on the show, more in our series of stories on the crushing heat in Milan, Italy. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Wildfires across southern Europe are causing massive damage. They forced thousands of people to evacuate their homes. In Greece, firefighters are battling fires on the outskirts of the nation's third largest city, Patras. Seven major fires in the country have already destroyed homes and businesses. Then there are more wildfires raging in France, Turkey, Albania, and Spain, where the UK's Channel 4 News spoke with some residents.
We are completely helpless and abandoned. Please, anyone, do something for us, because we are burning. No one does anything. No one.
There's nothing left. The wildlife has been completely wiped out. Everything. All the vegetation and wildlife, too. There used to be lots of wild boar, all kinds of animals, and this has destroyed everything.
Making the situation worse are scorching temperatures and drought conditions. In parts of southern Europe today, temperatures shot up to 104 degrees Fahrenheit. In Italy, a four-year-old boy died from heat stroke, while 16 cities across the country, including Rome and Milan, have been placed under the highest heat alerts. Environmentalists say Italian lawmakers are doing far too little in response. But in Milan, some locals are taking matters into their own hands, as we hear from the World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry.
Federico Del Prete meets me on a brightly painted street called Via Sacchini in the north of Milan.
Via Sacchini is a street that has few residential buildings and a huge school compound.
The road outside the school has been closed off to cars, and instead, picnic benches stretch the length of the street.
The parents and also the neighbor community decided to make it car-free and to set plants, trees, benches, ping-pong tables.
Del Prete is with Lega Ambiente, an environmental organisation in Milan, and his group has decided to take things one step further.
We decided to partially open the blacktop to let the trees go into the ground, deeply into the ground.
Ripping up the asphalt means planting more trees to shade the street. The project is funded by a biscuit company. Del Prete says Milan City Council supports the idea, but with words, not cash. Locals have taken charge of several streets this way across the city. But Del Prete's vision is longer term, he says, and could really cool down an area. Sammy Sanchez from Peru is sitting at one of the benches, scrolling through her phone.
I
come here because I like this place, she says. It's quiet and peaceful. I call it the park, she says. Sanchez is used to warm summers back home. But Milan seems much hotter, she says. Right now, she's working as a caregiver for an elderly woman.
È troppo caldo. Troppo, troppo caldo.
All the time she complains it's too hot, Sanchez says. It's a complaint Paola Berritelli hears a lot too. She volunteers with AUSER, a group that supports vulnerable people, especially the elderly.
Giornate di calore non si muovono, molto semplicemente.
During hot days, many older people don't want to move or go outside, she says. Climate change affects everyone, but for them, it means isolation. Berritelli and her colleagues visit seniors at home, taking them for walks in the early morning or evening when the temperatures go down. It's a small measure, but in this heat, every little bit of human contact helps, she says. In Opera, a town just south of Milan, Red Cross volunteers have come up with another solution that's used in other countries, but not here.
Buongiorno.
Danilo Esposito, vice president of the local Red Cross, shows me around Italy's first cooling centre.
Allora no, funziona con due modalità. Con delle attività costruite come quella.
The centre works in two ways, he says. On days like today, there's activities for seniors, like climate talks and tips about dealing with heat. And when temperatures get really high, he says, the centre opens up to anyone who needs to come here and cool off for the day. Solar panels on the roof power the building. A little later, a woman appears at the door. My name is Rita Gennare, she says. Gennare is 80 years old and lives in a sixth floor apartment.
Anche a parte che la mia casa è molto calda e così, allora ci vuole un...
My home gets really hot, she says. It's often close to 90 degrees Fahrenheit indoors. Gennare says she's here because she's curious.
Mi interessano queste cose perché anche a casa vedo molto documentari sul clima.
I see a lot of documentaries about climate change, about what's happening to the coral reefs. I'm interested. I want to learn more, she says. Also, she was hoping there'd be someone to play cards with. The centre only opened last month and so far has received little support from local or national government. Volunteer Danilo Esposito says it may be the first of its kind in Italy, but with this sort of weather, it won't be the last, he says. Back on Via Sacchini, activist Federico Del Prete says part of the problem lies with Milan's mayor. He has a very single-minded approach to the city, he says.
You need a vision. He has only one vision. Milan is the city of people that want to work. Work, work, work.
But a city is much more than that, Del Prete says. It's about culture and history, and it should be a place for everyone, he says. And with that, he hops on his bicycle and pedals off down the painted street. For the world, I'm Orla Barry. Milan.
Get all of Orla's stories on how Milan is coping with the heat online at theworld.org. For a lot of people, going out for a simple jog can be one of the easiest ways to get some fresh air, stay active, and maybe even achieve that runner's high from all the endorphins. But for many women, going on a run can also bring unwelcome attention. Catcalling, for example.
We get honked at, the staring, the hanging out of the window just to look at us, and it's so, so, so prevalent.
That's Abby Hayward, a police officer in the English county of Surrey, speaking there on LBC Talk Radio. Hayward is part of a new police operation that's designed to address the problem of catcalling. It works like this. Along with other women in the police force, Hayward goes out running in plain clothes. Police units wait nearby to intervene the moment any abuse takes place. She says it's worked. In the first month of starting the operation, LBC Radio reports that Surrey police made 18 arrests for harassment, sexual assault, and theft. Here's Inspector John Vale.
Those kind of behaviours may not be criminal offences in themselves, but they still need to be addressed. And of course, the people that are likely to commit those kind of behaviours, they may then go on to commit more serious offences or more serious behaviours.
A 2024 study by the University of Manchester in the UK found that more than two-thirds of women surveyed experienced harassment while running. That includes threats, verbal abuse, and having objects thrown at them. Surrey's isn't the only police force trying unconventional ways to tackle this problem. The English city of Bradford rolled out a similar plan last year, and in London, the Metropolitan Police have tried out a buddy system where police officers joined a women's running club after members reported ongoing harassment. More global news is for you just ahead. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. North Korea has a secret army of tech workers applying for remote IT jobs around the world, and sometimes they actually get hired. They collect paychecks. They also steal company data and answer to a boss who is not at company headquarters. Instead, that person is sitting back in the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. So what happens when one of these workers makes it through the hiring process at a U.S. company? For the next few minutes, we'll find out in this report from Dina Temple-Raston, host of the Click Here podcast from Recorded Future News.
Finding the right employee can be like searching for a needle in a haystack. You craft the perfect job description. You brace yourself for the flood of resumes, some sparkling with promise, others maybe not so much. And then begins the painstaking process of interviews, follow-ups, gut checks. Even at the best of times, it can be exhausting. And Brian Jack went through all that last summer. He's the chief information security officer at KnowBe4. It's a cybersecurity training company.
We were hiring for a principal software engineer that was going to be writing code and applications on our IT team. Someone who was able to have lots of experience in writing full-stack code.
Full stack code. Basically, that means being able to write both the part of the application that a user sees or interacts with and the back end, the database and the logic that underpins it.
So we needed someone who was familiar with infrastructure as code, CI/CD pipelines, good software engineering practices, and they could mentor other software engineers.
So someone with technical expertise and leadership. It's a tough combination. Some might call it a unicorn. But here's the thing about unicorns. They don't exist. Or do they?
It was a pretty senior role. It paid really well.
Not just someone senior, someone rare.
Right. It's not that you can find someone with the level of skill set in every resume.
So they posted the job, and then thousands of resumes came in.
We get a couple thousands of resumes per job posting.
And one stood out from someone named Kyle. He had a degree from the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, check. An Atlanta address, check. Impeccable coding credentials, check, check, check.
We're thinking that this guy was going to make a really great employee, a great fit.
And he sailed through the HR process. The interviews, smooth. Phone, Zoom, no red flags. And then he happily signed the job offer, filled out all the paperwork, and the team from KnowBe4 was, well, excited. Then they shipped him out a laptop. Though when they shipped it out, there was this one small thing. Kyle asked KnowBe4 to send the laptop to a different state from the one on his employment form. Odd, but then again, remote work is nomadic, so all systems go. Yay. And then, the night before Kyle's first day, around 9 p.m., an alert sounds on the KnowBe4 network. Something weird was coming into the system from what looked like Kyle's computer. Someone was trying to run code on that new laptop. And it wasn't just any code, it was malicious code. All of a sudden, what started as a routine hire was anything but. So from the moment the computer arrives at its destination and boots up, the folks at KnowBe4 can see what the computer is up to.
Our security software is already monitoring what is going on.
And when the malware was starting to run on that new laptop, they could see that too. And this malware, it wasn't subtle. They could see it searching, scanning for credentials, users, passwords, looking for the kinds of things that hackers look for when they're trying to pry open a company's network.
We don't like to jump to conclusions because you'll end up going down a rabbit hole.
So they began by giving Kyle the benefit of the doubt. Maybe the poor guy's laptop was compromised before he even started. Not exactly the welcome gift you'd want from a new employer.
So our first instinct was to reach out to the individual and ask them what was going on. So we opened up Slack, and the lead of the Security Operations Center reached out to that user and asked them what was going on.
Yeah, sorry, Kyle replied. Just trying to troubleshoot this router. The security team gathered on Slack.
We have an investigations war room that we can fire up when we have an incident.
And they began spitballing a bunch of possible explanations for what they were seeing. And minutes go by. Sorry for the confusion, Kyle writes in Slack. I'm not sure what's going on. So NoB4's IT guys do what IT guys do best, the thing we love about IT guys. They offered to take a look.
Well, let us help you. You know, what is your router? What are you trying to configure? What's going on? At this point, if you were, not a spy or a fraud, you would have, of course, accepted this help with open arms. But in this case, this is where he started to shut down.
Kyle said that he was following the router guide. Maybe the link was just bad?
And when we asked them to provide us the link or provide the guide to be helpful or to hop on a quick voice chat or video chat to help them, that's when we stopped getting responses.
He did finally reply later that night with an apologetic message. He couldn't onboard the next day as planned, he said. His wife was having heart trouble and he needed to take her to the hospital. Only problem was, on all his forms, Kyle had listed himself as single. It was one red flag too many.
And I said, lock the machine.
Lock the machine. As Brian's team dug deeper, the pieces started falling into place. The malicious code wasn't coming from outside the company. It was coming from Kyle's machine, which meant this wasn't an external attack. Kyle, whoever he was the attack. The next morning, HR sent Kyle a notice. They said he was fired. And they also asked for his company laptop back. And they kind of assumed that was gone. After all, it was evidence. But then Kyle surprised them again. He didn't argue.
And they said, no problem, where should we send it?
For all the trouble Kyle had caused, he clearly didn't want to add theft of corporate property to the list.
These laptops aren't cheap, $2,000-$3,000, that's grand theft.
But Brian didn't leave it there. He wanted backup to figure out what really was going on. So they called in some experts, Google's Mandiant. And the case landed on the desk of a guy named Michael Barnhart.
I also go by Barney, and I do a lot of the North Korean operations.
Michael now works as an insider risk investigator at a cybersecurity company called DTEX. And his specialty is hunting down nation-state hackers, like those working for North Korea. And he has this kind of crazy way of keeping track of his hacker takedowns. He tattoos their names on his body, specifically his foot.
I got a tattoo of the APT-43. I got that on my foot with our unit name on it. And I'll keep doing it on my, this one foot is dedicated to North Korean amputees, apparently.
Okay. Nothing like an ankle of justice, I always say.
Michael and his ankle of justice took a deep dive into Kyle's laptop, analyzed the malware, and came back with a bombshell. Kyle wasn't a coder from Atlanta, he told Brian.
You guys, you actually hired a guy from North Korea. Everybody's mind was blown.
They guessed that Kyle was up to something fishy, but they hadn't even begun to imagine that he might be North Korean. This was just the beginning of their questions. Then who exactly was Kyle? He didn't appear to be North Korean in their interviews, and why would their relatively small company be targeted for something like this? It turned out they weren't alone.
A U.S. citizen in North Carolina is accused of working with North Korea.
Nashville man is accused of trying to help North Korea.
An Arizona woman has been indicted in a series of complex identity theft cases, generating money for the North Korean government.
It's a whole program dreamed up by Pyongyang to get around sanctions and funnel money and stolen data back to the regime. And the sanctions aren't just a U.S. thing. Even the United Nations bans member states from hiring North Korean workers because, the Security Council says, the government uses these workers to raise money for North Korean Kim Jong-un's weapons program. To Michael Barnhart, all this made perfect sense. North Korea has been strangled by global sanctions for years, so they'd adapted, created workarounds, including an entire undercover IT workforce. After COVID, there were more people working remotely than ever before, which is just fine if you know your employees and have actually met them. But remote work leaves companies vulnerable to fraudsters who might not be so honest.
You can find on these leak sites on the dark web, you know, all these different passports, all these different driver's licenses. You know, they go there and then they'll start altering those. Again, this is a criminal enterprise. So you got to think of it like a mob movie at times. You know, you have the guy, you got the getaway driver, and you've got the English speaker, and you've got the resume builder. It's everyone has these different parts to play.
Sometimes they get help from a real human outside of North Korea, a Westerner who's willing to act like they're applying for a job in exchange for a kickback once the North Koreans land the work. Michael says the North Koreans tend to go for tech gigs, things like animators or coders, because you don't need to be in an office to do them. And you can juggle multiple jobs and no one's the wiser.
We see guys with up to 5, 6, 7 jobs, and they're holding all at once. And you see them lean into scripting. You see them leaning to automation and AI to help. You know, they're making little tiny bots of themselves to go do work at these other places.
Yes, little AI assistants, helping them scale up and collect more paychecks. It's a numbers game. The more jobs you land, the more money flows back to North Korea, and the happier you make the supreme leader. If you've ever wondered how a country that can't even feed its own people can afford such a sophisticated missile program, it's partly because of schemes like this. Kim uses money from their many Kyles to pay for it all. As a general matter, there are two ways these North Korean IT warriors get hired. Sometimes they apply directly, with fake names and stolen identities like we talked about before. Mandiant reviewed some of their resumes, and they do look like they belong to someone you'd want to hire, which, of course, is the point. There are glowing testimonials from CEOs who never wrote them, images swiped from unsuspecting LinkedIn profiles, lengthy lists of hard-to-find skills. And then there's this second approach. Find an American, maybe somebody struggling to find a job, and turn them into a kind of Trojan IT guy that makes it look like these North Korean workers are actually working from someplace local, like North Carolina or Georgia.
It definitely needs to look like it's coming from where I said I lived. I'm going to purchase a person. I'm going to recruit them on XYZ, you know, job platform. Say, hey, I'll give you a couple $1,000. I need you to sit in on meetings randomly.
This isn't a tough job. Basically, it just requires this facilitator to keep a laptop running. Lots of laptops, actually. They even have a name for this. It's called a laptop farm.
A guy can sit there and plug in 10, 12, 90 laptops in some cases into his house. And then for every laptop, you know, you get $500.
It's easy to imagine someone just has to set up these laptops that companies like KnowBe4 send their new remote Kyles for work, and then they get software that makes it look like the mouse is always moving, so it looks like someone is working around the clock. And Bob's your uncle. And that's probably how it happened at KnowBe4. An IT guy calling himself Kyle applied. Maybe he was in the U.S., maybe he wasn't, but chances are he had help. An American facilitator, someone running one of those laptop farms. And here's the kicker. These people who are running these laptop farms might not even know they're working for North Korea. To them, it's just easy money. KnowBe4 is just one of many companies unwittingly caught up in this North Korean program. One case brought by the FBI last year involved 300 companies and 60 stolen identities. It all happened over 6 years, and some $90 million was rerouted to North Korea. FBI Special Agent Ashley Johnson said it isn't just a hacking operation.
It could impact our national security if we have money going back to another government that forms any type of program or funds any type of program that could then be used against us adversarially.
This is Agent Johnson speaking at a news conference announcing the indictments. And she says that any company that hires remote IT workers should be concerned.
More likely than not, you have hired or at least interviewed a North Korean national working behalf of the North Korean government.
9 months after Nobifor's brush with Kyle, Brian says there's been a bit of a crackdown.
So our CEO told the hiring team, listen, now you guys have been provided the tools. You know what to look out for. You know this is a thing. You're all fired if it happens again.
And Brian says now he knows what to look for, the telltale signs of a North Korean on the make.
There's kind of these email addresses that you can tell the format, or they'll use certain keywords like cool or ninja or .dev, or then they add some numbers at the end, like they will add either a date like 1957. It's just you'll start to see that there's a pattern where those terms are used more frequently in North Korean IT workers.
And if the applicants include images, he checks the metadata, location tags, little telltale signs of Photoshop. And using this new approach, he actually just spotted a suspicious applicant just a few months ago. He decided to interview the guy just to see what he could learn, and he shared the recording of the interview with us.
I see a strong alignment with what your team is doing, yeah. And I also appreciate the company's culture.
I have strong alignment with your team. I appreciate the company culture. Charming, if a bit robotic. Then Brian asked them how they feel about using AI for security. And the answer?
I can say I'm a big fan of OpenAI.
I'm a big fan of OpenAI. Brian is still getting those suspicious resumes.
They have brought two or three to me in the last couple of months. They said, we're not going to interview this person, but just so you know, I think this resume that I just looked at is North Korean IT worker. And I'll go and I'll look at it and I'll confirm it. And I'll be like, you guys, you got it. Like, you're dialed in now. This is excellent.
Hiring used to just be about finding the right candidate. Now, it's also about spotting the ones who aren't really candidates at all. For The World, I'm Dina Temple Raston.
Dina Temple Raston is host of the Click Here podcast from Recorded Future News. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A startling new statistic in the growing body of research on loneliness worldwide. Nearly a quarter of people living in Africa are suffering from social isolation. That's according to a recent report from the World Health Organization. 24%, actually. That was the highest percentage of people saying they are lonely out of all the regions of the world surveyed by the WHO. Latifa Odunaga is a psychologist and global advisor for the African Network of Youth Policy Experts and joins us from Newark, New Jersey. Latifa, what was your reaction when you first saw the numbers in that report?
I would say that I was surprised, and I would also say that I'm not surprised. Surprised because in my head, I would think that Africa, we're supposed to be a closely knit community. But then when we look at the things that have happened even before COVID and now after COVID, I wouldn't be surprised. I would think that even there should be an increase in that number because a lot of young persons are really lonely. They're really socially isolated. Nigeria has, not even Nigeria, Africa now. We don't have a lot of mental health providers. We don't have a lot of psychiatrists. In Nigeria, for example, we have only about a little bit over 200 psychiatrists.
For Nigeria?
Yes, for the whole Nigeria. And we have a population of over 200 million people. So can you imagine what it would be if you needed to have access to seeing a psychiatrist and you have a mental health struggle? You're not going to get anywhere. In the U.S., you might be told, oh, we're going to put you on a waiting list. Yeah, there's no waiting list.
So looking at the study as it stands right now, how serious a problem are loneliness and isolation across the continent?
Across the continent is a very serious issue. We're seeing what's going on with TikTok. A lot of our young persons are spending more time on TikTok. In 2021 alone, TikTok recorded a download of over 1 billion worldwide, like particularly after COVID. And we've not healed from the aftermath of COVID. So it's kind of pretty hard. People need to be informed. Mental health stigma in Africa is still a thing that we're still managing. And now talking about loneliness and social isolation, I feel the language is a little bit more relaxed. People can relate. And because of that, it's very easy for us to say, listen, as Africans, we're usually closely knit in our communities. So we can use that because we've always had that. But these new things that are coming into our societies are now making us far apart. So we have to go back to our drawing board and look at systems, look at family systems that we can bring back, you know, to foster this social connection.
So the WHO report noted that, this is a quote, links between loneliness and poorer physical and cognitive health are stronger in more collectivistic countries. I'm wondering if you can help us understand what collectivism means here and how that might play a role in African countries with this loneliness trend.
So in a collectivistic society, it means that people will actually do things as a community, which can be one of the indicators of us saying we are socially connected. We are coming from a closely knit community. And our foreign to support that is something happened to my brother means something is happening to all of us, right? We see all of us as one. When one person is injured, we are all injured. So in a collectivistic society, we do things together.
Well, Latifa, you're from Nigeria. How important is community where you grew up?
Community is everything. I'll give you a classic example. Growing up, my grandmother used to tell us stories, and we sat down on mat. We sat down in a big circle as she made this tea. And when we drank this tea, at 7 p.m., she told us different stories. The storytelling circle was a way where we knew what was going on in our community. We know whose child was absent. We know whose father is sick, because if someone was missing, my grandmother would say, take the lamp and go find this person in their home. They have to be here, you know. And she demonstrated the stories. And these stories resonated with us. These stories was something that was very important that has shaped a lot of our lives. So this is how we lived. We ate together. Eating together meant everything to us. It's like you want to make a whole pot of jollof rice, right? And someone has a match. Someone has fires. Someone has to go fetch the wood. Someone has to go do this. We did things together because we know that the result, doing things together, is better than just doing things alone.
Initially, though, I'm wondering if maybe you're seeing even just an urban-rural divide, that perhaps one area feels more lonely than the other.
Currently in Africa, there is a need for us to really look more into these discrepancies between urban and rural cities. Some rural towns or communities in Africa might not have that technology access like other urban cities that are experiencing stress, that are experiencing these financial hardships. So there's going to be a difference in how people feel more lonely, how people feel more isolated. I feel like in the rural areas, people rely on community because they don't have those extensive digital apps that they're going to be on TikTok. But these things are proliferating into these communities now. So I feel like we need to do more extensive research as to that.
So you spoke about technology access a moment ago. How has technology, I'm hearing in that social media, how has that actually changed the loneliness factor in Africa?
Technology has changed in the sense that in Africa, whenever you have an issue, there is a chain of command that you have to go through. You have to tell your parents, I'm dealing with this issue. No matter what age you are, you always know the way to go back home. And if your parents can resolve this, if like you have an issue with your parent, you have to go to someone in that family that kind of has like more influence over your parent that can talk to them. So you're just randomly chatting with people that you barely know, or people who barely have an idea of what's going on in your family now want to make contribution about your life. So these are the issues with what technology is bringing. Some part of technology is actually very positive for us, but we're seeing a lot of dangers. We're seeing a lot of young people talking to these AI bots. These AI bots are instructing them to go end their lives, to go hurt someone in their family. These are the dangers that we are seeing with this increased technology access and the proliferation of this artificial intelligence and technology that we have access to now.
You mentioned the stigma around mental health issues in many African countries, not enough psychiatrists and social workers. How do you start to address the loneliness issue when that is the reality?
this issue on loneliness, we have to talk about it, and not just talk about it, we have to do something about it. Zimbabwe has this program called the Friendship Bench, and that's a beautiful program, right?
The Friendship Bench, yeah.
Yeah, the Friendship Bench is a very beautiful program. But if you see what Zimbabwe is doing, you know, they're relying on that community support. They're relying on the community support because they know that we have that. And that's what I told you. My grandmother has this art in front of her house where this is where everybody comes together. You get the information on, you know, who is getting a job tomorrow. This is our news up. We have to go gentle, right? We have to go gentle so that we can be able to understand what loneliness means on the African continent.
Latifat Odunaga is a psychologist from Nigeria with the African Network of Youth Policy Experts. She spoke with us from Newark, New Jersey. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Curtis L. Scribner, Frank Washington, Leanne Hahn, Lizzie and Dan Routman, and Sarah and Stephen Bass. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.